Dee Dee asked. Found Mike Davis, didn't I? And the guidance counselor from Roxana's high school. You have your network? I have mine. Dee Dee appeared less frowny, but still troubled. How far are you going to take this? She asked abruptly. I don't know. If you find Anya, if you decide she did shoot and kill 4 people today, will I burn her alive? I asked bluntly. Or subject her to some other form of your justice? I don't actually like hurting people, I said, but I couldn't tell if Dee Dee believed me or not. I'll get her story, I stated at last. I'll report back to you, just as I did after talking to Mike Davis, who you now apparently have someone following. If he meets up with Roxy, wouldn't you like to know? And if Anya looks good as the shooter, wouldn't you want eyes on her as well? I don't trust you, Dee Dee said again. Phil muttered something under his breath that was no doubt agreement. You're too hard, Dee Dee continued. Too angry. Makes you unpredictable. Funny comment coming from you. Yeah? Gonna tell me about the bandage on your hand and why it keeps showing fresh blood? I injured myself, all right? No. No, it's not. Because that's the truth, but not the whole truth, which is a problem when someone like you is talking to someone like me. I glared at her, my left hand now tucked self-consciously behind me. I'm getting a dog today, Dee Dee said abruptly, which threw me for a loop while earning a startled glance from Phil. My husband and son are looking for the lucky pooch right now, which means I have 3 good reasons to go home tonight. Husband, child, dog. What about you, Flora? What incentive do you have to do right? It was a good question, one I hadn't thought of for a long time. I should say my mother, who loved me very much, sacrificed, endured, baked. Or there was Samuel, my FBI victim advocate, who'd taken dozens of middle-of-the-night calls over the years. There was also my brother, somewhere overseas, who I knew still loved me. Or maybe my group, my new little band of misfits who looked up to me. I had a life. I wasn't sure exactly when or how it had happened, but I had a life, which I guess went to prove I hadn't lied to Sarah when I first showed up on her doorstep. You could survive something horrific and still learn how to live again. I'll report back, I said at last. Dee Dee continued with her stare. Then, when I didn't blink, be careful. Always. I sauntered off, in search of a killer. And as happy as a girl like me was ever gonna get. Chapter 20 Dee Dee had a text from home, with a photo. She desperately wanted to unlock her screen and view it. Photo of dog? Photo of Alex and Jack with dog? Photo of anything at all from home? Because she could use a slice of family right now, a moment to remember the good things in life. But first things first, she got on the phone with Neil. She and Phil liked to tease Boston's youngest detective about his bright red hair and perpetually youthful features, calling him the Richie Cunningham of homicide detectives. In truth, Neil had matured nicely over the past few years. With the addition of Carol Manley to the squad, he was no longer the rookie and had taken the lead on more investigative angles. If Dee Dee felt like a proud mama, then Phil was a positively beaming papa. Any more major findings from the Baez residence? Dee Dee asked Neil now. Nothing that stands out. Interviews with the neighbors? Everyone agrees that they seemed like a normal family. No loud arguments, parties, no strangers coming and going at odd hours. Sounds like Juanita was a good cook, while Charlie was known to help with small fix-it jobs around the neighborhood. Everyone liked them, though no one seems to have known them that well. Juanita and the kids only moved in during the past year. Anyone see the shooter walk into the home shortly before 9 a.m.? No. What about images from security cameras on the street behind the Boyd Baez place? We know the shooter jumped the fence. He or she disabled the video cameras on that building, but surely there are some other systems on the block. And yet, no. Really? This is a densely populated area. Whatever happened to Big Brother's always watching? Dee Dee asked crankily. Not on that block, Neil informed her. I've been digging into the family finances. So far, it all appears pretty straightforward. Monthly paychecks in, monthly expenses out. No major deposits or withdrawals. Limited credit card activity. They weren't living high on the hog, but they were getting by. What about cash transactions? Anything that might indicate illegal activities, drugs? Charlie's contracting seems to be a mix of working as a sub on bigger jobs with some smaller independent projects on the side. For many of those, he probably was paid in cash, but again, no unexplained deposits or high-end purchases, say jewelry, electronics, designer shoes, favored by drug lords to launder their profits. And we didn't find a safe in the house or hidey hole under the bed, not even a wad of bills in the freezer. So on a scale of 1 to 10, the odds of Charlie or Juanita being closet drug dealers, Dee Dee prompted, I'd score them a 3. And only that high because clearly something was going on, sinister enough to lead to a quadruple murder. But Carol and I have scoured the residence from top to bottom at this point. No sign of drug paraphernalia. Just... Dee Dee heard a faint wobble in Neil's voice. A normal family living a normal life in a normal home. Dee Dee didn't speak right away. She knew what he meant. Neil wasn't married with kids. In fact, he was a gay man who'd grown up in a family of Irish Catholic drunks, and yet the domestic case has always hit hard. A father figure gunned down while still sitting on his sofa. A mom shot to death in her own kitchen. And the kids. Dee Dee still couldn't think about the kids. Ben completed a cursory exam of the bodies at the scene, Neil was saying now, referring to Ben Whiteley, Boston's M.E., and one of Neil's former lovers. No sign of obvious needle marks on Juanita or Charlie. Of course, Ben issued his usual caveat. Nothing is final till he can complete his exam back at the lab, Dee Dee intoned. Exactly. What about Lola Baez? Dee Dee asked. For the first time, she heard surprise in Neil's voice. The 13-year-old? What about her? There's a rumor Lola Baez was part of a gang, possibly dealing drugs, possibly using drugs. We're not sure. Silence as Neil contemplated the matter. Ben will run a talk screen. That's SOP for cases like this. If you really want to be thorough, however, I can ask him to run a segmented analysis of Lola Baez's hair. That would not only tell us conclusively if she was doing drugs, but an approximate timeline for when she started, or ended, for that matter. Dee Dee was impressed. Excellent, and timeline is exactly what we need. In the last year, things changed for this family. Juanita met Charlie, then moved herself and her kids into his house in Brighton, which, it sounds like, also returned her children to some unfinished business from their time in a nearby foster home. The more tightly we can reconstruct the past few months of the family's lives, the better. Got it, Neil assured her. Anything else I should know? Dee Dee asked, because Neil was a leader in his own right now, and she was proud of him for it. Found a life insurance policy on Charlie, Neil reported. 20,000. Beneficiary is Juanita. At this point, you're basically talking enough money to cover funeral expenses. Times 4, Dee Dee thought. House is in Charlie's name, Neil continued. No sign of a will, meaning most likely the real estate will end up in probate. All in all, not a lot of financial motive to kill off Charlie the contractor. All right. Dee Dee chewed her lower lip. As lead investigator, she had only so many resources at her disposal. After the initial call out, she'd focused the detectives and patrol officers in the immediate vicinity of the Boyd Baez residence. But now, nearly 7 hours later, with a fresh shooting and a possible sighting of Roxana in the area around the coffee shop, it felt that their geography had changed. And based on what they'd learned about the family, probably their line of questioning as well. I want you to focus on the kids, Dee Dee told Neil. You take Lola, give Manny Baez to Carol. Forget additional interviews with neighbors. It's schools, teachers, best friends, worst enemies. In particular, I need to know everything about the year the kids were in state care. I'm headed to the foster home where Lola and Roxana were placed. But what about Lola's teacher, classmates from that year? Friends she kept, friends she dumped, I don't know. But it sounds like Juanita Baez suspected Lola had been abused in foster care. She was working with a lawyer on a possible lawsuit. Interesting, Neil said. Anyone you approach, find out if Juanita talked to them as well. I want to retrace her investigative steps, so to speak. Clearly, she was stirring the pot. So who did she spook? You think she might have been onto something? People who'd have incentive to cover up the initial crime, not to mention avoid the financial and PR disaster of a major trial. Exactly. Which brings us to Roxana Baez. It sounds like she was afraid of something. For herself, her sister, we're not sure, but the past couple of weeks, something had her on edge. Oh, which reminds me, I should probably tell you about our newest player in this mess, Flora Dane. What? No mistaking the surprise in Neil's voice now. She approached Phil and me earlier today. Apparently, she's started some support group for survivors, and Roxana Baez is their newest member. What? Neil said again, sounding even more surprised. It's possible Flora is going to help us find Roxy. At least, I signed her up as my CI. You're crazy, Neil said flatly, which was a testimony to just how long he and Dee Dee had worked together. Plenty of her fellow detectives thought she was obsessive and insane. Very few called her on it. I'm sure Phil agrees with you, Dee Dee assured him now, glancing down the street where Phil stood working his own phone. But the fact remains, we need to know everything there is to know about Roxana Baez, and we need that information yesterday. Frankly, Flora already has an in with the girl, and we could use the help. Total silence from Neil. I'm sorry. She couldn't quite help the sarcasm leaking into her voice now. Have you magically found Roxy and just forgot to tell me? Neighborhood patrols turned her up? You're staring at her as we speak. No, Neil admitted grudgingly. Have you heard about Hector's shooting? Did you know Flora helped identify Roxy's hideaway across the street, or knew that Roxy is carrying a light blue backpack, which we can now add to our search description? So Roxy shot Hector? Neil asked, no longer so hostile, more like resigned to his fate. Dee Dee sighed heavily, her own temper fading. I want to say yes, but honestly I'm not sure. Roxy was tucked away in an abandoned real estate office across from the scene. Someone matching her description fled the area. We have uniformed officers scouring the area, as well as pulling security tapes, which might show us if it definitely was Roxy and her backpack people saw running away. My problem is, why would Roxy shoot Hector? Let alone her entire family, Neil finished for her. At least on this end, Carol and I haven't uncovered anything to suggest Roxy was feuding with her mom or involved in anything illegal. Not even any evidence of an evil boyfriend. All reports are that she loved her siblings, Dee Dee agreed, and went out of her way to protect them. So if Roxy's innocent, why hasn't she turned herself in? Neil asked. What's she hiding for? If I had to guess, I think she's afraid. Of what? Honestly, Neil, that's what we'd better figure out. Dee Dee ended the call. Phil had put away his own phone and was now waiting for her. I have two sets of contact info, he announced. One for the girls, foster placement, the other for Juanita's lawyer. Dee Dee considered the matter. Any allegations of abuse, the foster parent is going to deny, deny, deny. On the other hand, the lawyer might have already dug up some evidence of the truth, Phil provided. Lawyer it is. Dee Dee glanced at her phone. The text from home she still hadn't read. The photo she still hadn't opened. Family. So much in life came down to family. She slid her phone into her pocket and followed Phil to his car. Chapter 21 The first few times I walked past the high school, I missed Sarah completely. I was looking for a thin female in neutral clothes tucked behind a tree or lurking around a bush. But directly across from the school was a sea of concrete, deli, mini-mart, pawn shop, all with a shared parking lot, not a tree or twig in sight for obscuring a wannabe spy. And inside the stores, it would be too difficult to peer deep into the school grounds, keep tabs on Mike Davis. I headed up the sidewalk in front of the school, then back down, keeping my head low. As Sarah had said, the school grounds were a busy place. Various kids running around in school uniforms, others clumped together in tight groups. I spotted Mike in a shadow near the end of the school building. He was doing his rocking back and forth on his heels. Maybe he had earbuds in. Maybe he was just listening to the music of his mind. Third pass, getting nervous now, I heard, "Psst." I turned toward the street, and sure enough, Sarah, not skulking, not pacing, but tucked down in the passenger seat of a parked car. She cracked the door open as I approached. "I didn't know you had a car."
"I don't. Found the door unlocked. Helped myself."
I nodded in admiration. Nice improvising.
"As you can tell, there's no good place to stand around watching, and given that I'm too old to be a student and too young to be a mom, I wasn't sure how long I could walk laps around the athletic fields without someone becoming suspicious."
I squatted down next to the vehicle. Basic silver economy car, student parking sticker on the windshield, collection of hair scrunchies wrapped around the shifter. I was more and more impressed. Sarah could be anyone's older sister, waiting for her siblings' practice to get out. She had her phone out in her hand, another nice touch, bored and texting to pass the time. Most people walking by probably didn't even see her, and those who happened to peer in notice a lone female staring at her phone. Nothing interesting to see here. "So, anything to report?" I asked, regarding Mr. Bojangles. Sarah was chewing gum, a concession to her nervousness over her first surveillance mission. Now she blew a bubble, let it pop. "Method acting," I thought. "Nah, he's just been bouncing around the same small area. Sometimes I swear his lips are moving. Maybe talking to all the voices in his head?
Or he has Bluetooth and is talking to someone on his phone."
Sarah blew another bubble, let it pop again. "No way I can get close enough to make that determination. I'm here to observe any meet-and-greets. So far, nada." I nodded, peered through the car windows to spy Mike doing exactly as Sarah had reported, bouncing on his toes, murmuring to empty air.
"So this is Roxana's BFF?" Sarah asked.
"Apparently."
"She's got a nurturing streak." This caught my attention. I studied Sarah so intently she flushed, smacked her gum.
"I mean, think about it. A kid like that? In the world of high school bullying, he basically has a target painted on his back. Roxy might be a serious student, but I've met her in person. She could do better." I get the impression he helped her and Lola out in foster care. Maybe hanging with him now is her way of returning the favor.
"Then loyal and nurturing," Sarah said. "You don't think she harmed her family?"
"Girl I met was too strung out to be that cold-blooded. If I'd heard she'd shot someone in self-defense, sure, but eliminate her entire family, then head out to walk the dogs? No way."
"The police need to speak with her," I said softly.
"I haven't heard from her," Sarah said flatly in response to my unasked question, which in the beginning made sense. She'd need to get out of Dodge before she'd feel safe enough to call. But now I'm getting nervous. I feel like if she did have the opportunity to reach out, well, we're the ones most likely to believe her story, right? If she can't confide in us, then who?
I nodded. I'd begun wondering the same thing myself, especially given the time. Nearly 5 p.m., the working hours of the day done, and still no word from her.
Sarah held up her phone. "I'm not just goofing off," she said. I squinted my eyes, peered at the screen.
"It's a memorial," I said, looking at the collage of photos.
"Yeah, I found a Facebook page for Roxana's mother, had a lot of family photos. So I set up a website in memory of the Baez family, posted the photos, little comments I found online, a virtual memorial."
I waited. Sarah had come far in the past year, from a ragged survivor barricaded in her studio apartment to now this.
"We can track IP addresses, see which ones visit the page again and again. Lots of people revisit memorials."
"Yeah, but Roxana's on the run, right? No computer or phone."
"I'm not sure, but if she does have a phone, the police will find her the moment she fires it up."
"Which everyone knows, right?" So if she wants news, and the girl has got to be desperate for news, she'll need to access a public computer. You know, hit the library, a cyber cafe, something like that. I nodded, getting it. So we can check for a repeating IP address from a public location. Look for her there. If we want to get really fancy, we can even look for patterns. Does the IP address hit the memorial address every hour on the hour? That sort of thing, which would tell us when to visit the public location.
Very clever.
I know.
You're doing a great job.
I know. She smacked her gum, blew another bubble. When she glanced at me, however, her eyes were sad. I really want to help her, Flora. I'm the one who made contact. I'm the one who brought her to the group. And now, I can't help but feel this is all my fault.
A woman approached Mike Davis, definitely not a student. Sarah and I had been talking and didn't see where she'd come from, but she was older, curling salt-and-pepper hair, wardrobe by Chico's, brown slacks, deep green sweater, light brown quilted jacket topped with green and gold silk scarf, a little high-end for athletic fields. A teacher? An administrator of some sort? She stopped directly in front of Mike. He was doing his bounce-bounce thing, but as she spoke, he stilled. Slowly, he removed one earbud, studied the woman, then spoke.
What about images from security cameras on the street behind the Boyd Baez place?
Tried again. He shook his head. Something about the exchange bothered me. Then I got it. She was the older, more authoritative figure. And yet, to go by body language, she wasn't talking down to the high schooler. She was pleading with him. Whatever she wanted, he wasn't giving it up. Back to bounce, bounce, bounce. From this distance, I couldn't see him well enough to know for sure, but I imagined his fingertips drumming against the top of his leg. Another minute or two, the older woman stepped back. She looked around, studying the sea of teens. Given the hour, school sports seemed to be winding down, more and more kids breaking apart from their assorted groups and heading off the grounds. Sarah already had her hand on the car door. It was time.
Want me to continue following him? She asked.
If you think you can.
I can.
All right. I watched the line the older woman followed off the school grounds. Then I headed in that direction, keeping my target in sight. The woman had parked one block over. She had just reached her vehicle, her hand on the door of a red Subaru, when I caught up. She turned sharply, met me head on.
Yes, she said, voice crisp, eyes direct.
I couldn't help myself. I fell back a step, felt my fingers automatically beginning to fidget. She had to be a teacher, because I immediately felt like I was back in school.
I'm a friend of Roxana Baez.
She stared at me.
What kind of friend? You're too old to be a student.
I thought fast.
We met in a kickboxing class. Roxy was interested in self-defense. I was teaching her. I could tell she was worried about something. I hoped I could help. Then, this morning, turning on the news, I shrugged miserably.
Your name?
Belatedly, I stuck out my hand.
Flora Dane.
A frown.
Do I know you?
I didn't say anything, just waited. After another moment, she took my hand.
Susan Howe, she said.
Are you a teacher?
Used to be. Taught seventh grade English for 30 years before retiring.
I believed it. But used to be? Which meant now she was simply a woman who knew both Roxy Baez and Mike Davis? In the next minute, I got it.
Are you with social services? I asked.
That's why you can't say anything directly. You don't want to violate Roxy's privacy.
If it helps, I know about the year she spent at Mother Dell's with her sister and Mike Davis. I spoke with Mike earlier today.
What did he have to say?
Never get caught alone at Mother Dell's?
Susan Howe grimaced. Her shoulders came down. Abruptly, she looked tired.
If only either had told me that sooner,
she murmured. Teaching kids was hard. Turns out trying to save them is near impossible.
Would you like a cup of coffee?
It occurred to me I hadn't eaten lunch, never mind that it was almost time for dinner.
How about a snack? There's a deli across from the school.
How about one not so close? I know an Italian place up the street.
I nodded. She locked her car, headed north.
Susan had a brisk walk. Everything about her radiated competence. I wondered if Roxy had liked her, or at least trusted her enough to confide in her. Sure enough, two blocks up, an Italian deli. Suddenly starving, I ordered a meatball sub with extra provolone. Susan went with coffee, black. I paid for mine, she paid for hers. We took a seat in a little brown booth that could have used a thorough cleaning. Susan Howe spread out a napkin in front of her, placed her coffee on that. I used my sandwich wrappings to do the same. "I'm not with Child Services," she said abruptly. "I'm a CASA volunteer. Do you know CASA?" A jingle from a radio commercial ran through my head. "Who will speak for me? Will you speak for me?" Something like that. I nodded. "A CASA volunteer works on behalf of a child in the court system. For example, if a child is removed from her parents and placed in foster care, then someone such as me would be assigned to work with the juvenile, helping him or her understand the process, while also making observations and submitting independent reports to the court on how the child is doing in the foster home environment, during meetings with the biological parent, etc. If the child has any requests, say a desire to see a sibling placed in a different home, she could ask me, and I'd direct the request up the chain of command. I don't have power. I can't give the child anything or make promises. Mostly, I'm there to listen, explain, and shepherd a child through a very stressful transition. If you're doing all this, I asked, what's the social worker doing? The DCF worker represents the state's interests. Given that it's a DCF agent who takes the kids away from their parents and places them in foster care, many youths view the worker as the enemy, though in fact a case agent is only trying to do what's best for the child. Let me put it to you this way. In court, the DCF caseworker sits to one side with the state's lawyer. The biological parent sits to the other side with his or her lawyer. I sit in the middle with the kids. Does that help understand my role in the madness? How long are you involved? It's complicated to terminate parental rights. Takes at least a year plus half a dozen hearings. The first hearing involves building the case for negligence or abuse. The second hearing spells out exactly what steps the parent must take to get her child back. Attend substance abuse counseling, get a job, establish stable housing, etc. Then there are subsequent hearings to check up on the parent's progress. My job is to explain all this to the kids, help them understand that, yes, their parent loves them, but he or she must complete these steps before the children can return home. I've been doing this for the past 5 years. In cases involving addiction, the requirements facing the parent seem nearly Herculean. How do they get a job when they already have a record for stealing to support their drug habit? How do they get stable housing if they don't have a job? And around they go. The system is meant to protect kids, not break up families. But in our current drug crisis, most parents don't get their kids back, I filled in. She nodded. And this is volunteer work? As I said earlier, I taught seventh graders for 30 years. Clearly I'm a glutton for punishment. I devoured the first half of my meatball sub. After a moment's consideration, when would I have a chance to eat again? I took on the second. Juanita Baez got her kids back, I said around a mouthful. Every now and then, the system works. Or there's an exception to every rule. She loved her kids, Susan said abruptly, the sadness on her face genuine. I don't work with the parents, I merely see them in court. But that woman loved her kids, and she fought for them. Because that's what it takes. When I first started out, I thought things would be more black and white. Bad parents who didn't deserve their kids, or good parents who needed time to get their act together. But all the parents, whether they're good or bad, they love their kids. And the kids, whether they should or not, love their parents. But particularly these past few years, it feels like the opioid epidemic is winning. As much as some of these people care about their children, in the end, they need drugs even more. Have you been following the foster care crisis in the news? I shook my head. There's been a nearly 30% jump in recent years of children removed from their homes. Basically, there are now over 9,000 kids in Massachusetts who currently need foster care families. Except the state doesn't have enough families to meet those needs. So where it used to be that a home could have no more than 4 foster kids, now the state is issuing waivers to permit 5, 6, 7 kids in the same home. I've heard stories of 10. But needless to say, this creates its own set of issues, including a couple of deaths of foster kids, charges of abuse at other places. Those headlines had caught my attention. The system's overcrowded. Too many kids in need, not enough resources, I summarized. Exactly. Which must make your life harder. As a volunteer, I only work with 1 child at a time, or, in the case of siblings, possibly 2 or 3. If a family involves 3 siblings, shouldn't all 3 be placed together? I didn't provide names, sticking to our policy of generalizations. Ideally, yes, but given the lack of available space in foster homes, it's a miracle that even 2 of them were together. Are homes monitored, screened? As much as DCF has time, which, given the sudden jump in business... Do you see things? Report things? I don't actually spend much time with the foster family. I see the kids in court. I meet with them at their request or offer to take them out. Let's get lunch and talk, that sort of thing. But they aren't zoo animals. I don't just sit around watching them. Can kids call you? They can, and they do. I have a separate cell phone I use for my CASA work. The number 1 request I get in the case of separated siblings is wanting to see the other family member. For example, I worked with 2 sisters once. They really missed their younger brother. I nodded, understanding. But I might also get a call over needing more clothes, articles for hygiene. These kids, they're often given less time to pack than convicted criminals before being shuttled off to their new home. And while the foster families are paid stipends and given a clothing allowance, Susan shrugged, a foster parent has many charges, whereas I bring single focus. It's easier for the child to ask me than I work within the system to make things happen. Okay. Medical requests work in a similar fashion, Susan stated abruptly. The child might make the request to me for a doctor's appointment. Then I arrange for the foster parent to take him or her. I waited, the last of my meatball sub dripping onto the brown paper wrappings. We practice this in training, given one of the top medical requests from girls is birth control. I didn't move. It can be shocking to have a 13-, 14-year-old girl demanding an appointment for birth control pills, condoms, whatever. Again, it's not my place to judge or grant permission. Just record, then work the system to determine the possibilities. Once, however, I had a very young girl make the request. 8 years old. I stared at her. Susan picked up her coffee mug, set it back down. Her hand was shaking. I asked her why. She wouldn't tell me. I did my best to inquire about relationships at school, in the foster home. Was there anything else she wanted to tell me? Of course, regardless of whether or not she felt the relationship was consensual, any kind of sexual activity with an 8-year-old is clearly abuse. But the girl wouldn't explain. In the end, she said the request wasn't for herself, but for her friend, an older girl who didn't have her own CASA volunteer. I told her I was willing to help, but I would need a name in order to do so, at which point the girl clammed up. Wouldn't say anything more. She withdrew her request. The subject was dropped. But recently, Susan took a deep breath. I've had a parent reappear. First time that's ever happened. Asking me questions about her girl's time in foster care, what I might have seen, what I might have known. And that's made me reconsider that afternoon. The 8-year-old's appeal. Susan looked at me. I wonder now if she was telling the truth about asking on behalf of a friend, because an 8-year-old is very young for birth control, whereas her 11-year-old sister, whom the 8-year-old clearly adored, an 11-year-old sister who years later would be making similar requests on behalf of a mystery friend, BFF123, which maybe should have been Sisterly Love 123? Did you relay these suspicions to the mom? I asked now. Yes, when I spoke to her 2 weeks ago.
What did she say?
She didn't. She took notes.
Then she cried.
I'm sorry, I said.
They were my success story,
Howe said abruptly.
5 years of doing this. 5 years of trying to help kids. They were my single success story. Children, mother, family, all better off.
Until today.
Until today.
She agreed.
After that, we didn't speak again.
Chapter 22. Name, Roxana Baez, grade 11, teacher, Mrs. Chula. Category, personal narrative. What is the perfect family? Part 4.
How do you know what you're going to be when you grow up? A loser? An addict? Or somehow one of those who rises above it all? How do you know when you're still my age that it's all going to work out in the end?
I see these kids. They wear the same shirt every day. They have a lunch bag, but there's nothing in it. They carry a binder, but their homework is never done. Some lash out, disrupt class, show the world their pain. But there are plenty more who never say a word. Just show up, sit in class, present, but separate. They know the world is there, but they also know it's already beyond their reach.
Adults judge. Kids, too. First thought in everyone's mind, girl's no good. Just like her mother. Boy's a loser, just like his father. But some children will go on to rule the world. We've all heard the stories. They'll channel their frustration and rage into business, political, athletic, artistic success. They'll become the feel-good profile on the news, a model for others to follow. How do you know which person you're going to be? Especially if you're a kid like me, with a mother who's an alcoholic and a father who's never existed. How do you know it's all going to work out when you're stuck in the soulless abyss that's foster care?
Mother Dells. 6 months after being torn away from our mom, I can't tell you if my sister and I are any better off. We'd gained a roof over our heads and food on the table, but those things didn't make it a home.
Lola and I steal butter knives, screwdrivers, fingernail files, anything we can find to help us survive one more night. It isn't enough to watch out for Roberto or Anya. They plot against us just as much as we struggle to outsmart them. They break dishes, bully other kids into breakdowns, burn cigarette holes in the ratty sofa, then blame us. Or really me. Anything to get Lola and me apart.
Lola can't sleep. The constant strain of being on guard, the endless chore of changing diapers and comforting babies. She started picking at her hair, pulling out dull black clumps while the smudges grow darker under her eyes. She's becoming one of those kids who shows up to school but is never really there. I tell her it will be okay. At least we have each other. And as long as our mom keeps following the steps, meeting the court's requirements, we'll all be together as a family soon. Except as days turn into weeks, weeks into months, it's becoming harder for either one of us to believe. Home is a distant memory, the nightly survival dance, our new reality. As I watch my little sister slip further and further away. I'm the oldest. It's my responsibility.
We should join sports, I announce one day. After school activities. Anything to give us more time away from Mother Dells. As a sixth grader, I have options. Soccer in the fall, basketball in the winter, softball in the spring. I've never played any sports before, but that's not the point. For Lola, however, after-school activities for third graders barely exist. Programs are meant for weekends, organized through a community or rec center, coached by a parent. She can kill an hour or two, but not much more. Walking home from the bus stop one day, however, I find the answer. A poster for the local theater. A production of Charles Dickens's Oliver Twist, Child Actors Wanted. I can't help but laugh. Seriously? Oliver Twist? Have they hung out in foster care recently? But then I read on. Rigorous. Intense. Only serious talents need apply. Rehearsals are several hours every other night and most weekends. In addition, once the play is off and running, it's perfect. Lola and I will join community theater and never come home to Mother Dell again. I drag Lola to the auditions. She doesn't want to go. She's tired. She's depressed. She just wants to hang out with the babies. But then we are there. She walks onto the stage, doing as she's told. The lights come on, she looks up, and my little sister comes alive. For the first time in months, she sparkles. She doesn't just stand on that stage, she owns it. Afterward, everyone bursts into applause. The other little kids look at her, awestruck. And that's it. My little sister becomes the first female Oliver Twist. I go to work on set design, recruiting Mike Davis, who needs to avoid Mother Dell's as much as we do. For someone who bounces and jangles all the time, he has an amazingly steady hand once he's focused. He's also an incredible artist, turning plain plywood into elaborately painted backdrops, while both of us steal any sharp objects we can find for our inevitable return to Mother Dell's. I think Oliver Twist would agree. Hope is a funny thing. You need it, then there are times you have to let it go again. Except, of course, you can't give up completely or there's no coming back. We have weekly meetings with my mother now. We tell her about our new lives in theater. She relates stories from her new job as an ER nurse. And yet, the better she appears, the more Lola and I retreat. Because it's too hard to go from her to Mother Dell. It's too painful to hope that she might really remain sober, that we might someday be a real family again. Manny. We see him once a week at the family meetings as well. He lights up every time he sees us. But now, 6 months later, he also runs easily to his foster mom at the end of the hour. I take to staring at my mother's face, the way she forces herself to watch as her son embraces another woman. Her penance, I think. I wonder if it would make her feel better to know what Lola and I are going through, that we dread every second of Mother Dell's. But maybe that's petty of me. Manny appears to have decent, caring foster parents. I have to hope it's true. The theater gives me hope. Watching my sister work the stage, belt out her lines, painting away with Mike quiet by my side. Later, running up the scaffolding, taking our seats along the lighting catwalk, the entire playhouse sprawled out beneath us. Up that high, everything feels small, insignificant. For a moment, we don't even worry about Mother Dell's. We're just kids, doing things kids like to do. Run, climb, laugh. First kiss. And another moment of hope. I'm going to survive this. And my sister and my brother, we're going to be one of those success stories. The kids who took all their rage and frustration and rose above, a model for others to follow. We return at night to Mother Dell's, to the babies and their crying and whimpering, to Roberto and Anya and their mind games. It's not so bad, because tomorrow we will have the theater again. And again. And again. Which means we should have known, right? We of all people. Nothing so good lasts forever. 8 weeks after rehearsal start, we come home to a bottle of whiskey, left on the floor of the baby's room. A note. Heard your mother's a drunk. What about you? Then a giggle coming from down the hall. Roberto and Anya waiting, watching, so much bigger and stronger than both of us. I look at the bottle. I'm the oldest. It's my responsibility. And yet, Lola... I love you, she tells me. Then, before I can stop her from grabbing and chugging the entire bottle, I'm sorry. The bottle empties. My sister collapses. I'm on the floor beside her, a scene from a very bad play. Then Mike is there, too, but neither of us say a word. Where are these perfect families? Can there even be such a thing? One where everything goes so right, where no one ever hurts each other? Or is there just me and my family, and all of the lessons we're still learning the hard way?
Chapter 23 Dee Dee and Phil had wanted to speak to Juanita Baez's lawyer before approaching the foster home, but after leaving two messages for the lawyer and receiving no reply, they switched gears. Mother Dell's, then lawyer, because the clock was ticking. And they couldn't afford to just stand around, or, in Dee Dee's case, to gaze longingly at a cell phone, desperate to see photos of a new dog in hopes of distraction. So Mother Dell's it was.
They found the place easily enough, a squat, two-story residence stuck in the middle of a haphazard row of townhouses. It had a waist-high, chain-link fence cordoning off a dusty stamp of yard that was dotted with discarded toys. Phil opened the gate and did the honors of escorting Dee Dee up the cracked walkway to the front porch. Two bikes leaned against the railing, clearly sized for younger kids. Tucked next to the house was a bin of plastic balls. Nothing that could go too far or inflict too much damage, Dee Dee noticed. She knocked, waited, knocked again. Finally, the door opened. A black kid stood in front of Dee Dee. He appeared to be about 8, with a shaved head and huge dark eyes. He looked at Dee Dee, then Phil, then Dee Dee again. He didn't say a word. "We're looking for Mother Dell," Dee Dee said at last, put off by the boy's unblinking stare. He nodded. "Can we come in?" He nodded again, still didn't move. Dee Dee placed a hand on the door and gently pushed. The boy fell back a step. Dee Dee and Phil followed him through a cluttered family room, yellow-stained walls, broken-down brown sofa, plastic cups, soda cans, empty chip bags. Finally, they came to what appeared to be the dining room. An enormous wooden picnic table sat in the middle, headed by an even larger woman. She looked up at Dee Dee and Phil's approach, white face enveloped in folds of flesh and capped by coarse salt-and-pepper hair. Dee Dee would peg the woman's age at anywhere between 30 and 130. It was just too hard to tell. The woman didn't get up from the table at their approach, but picked up a napkin and wiped her hands. Around her sat 4 kids, ranging in age from 6 to 12. Dee Dee saw neither a teenage boy nor a teenage girl among them. She and Phil appeared to have interrupted dinner, a tinfoil baking tray filled with noodles and smelling like fish. Tuna noodle casserole, maybe? It had never been one of Dee Dee's favorites, and given the way the kids were pushing the noodles around on their plates, not one of theirs either. "I'm Sergeant Dee Dee Warren, Boston PD." Dee Dee did the honors. "This is Detective Phil LeBlanc. We have some questions regarding the Baez family. We understand that Lola and Roxana Baez lived here for a bit." Mother Dell grunted, finally pushing back from the table. Dee Dee realized the woman was sitting in a lawn chair, one of the largest metal-framed chairs she'd ever seen, and probably still had to be replaced regularly, given the strain. From upstairs came the sound of a baby crying. "Ricky," Mother Dell addressed Dee Dee's somber escort, "upstairs now." The boy scooted immediately out of the room, apparently grateful to make his escape. "You three, finish what's on your plates, then dishes. Go." More hasty actions, the kids scooping up the remaining mounds of casserole from their plates and downing the congealed mass in one determined swallow, then flying from the table, plates and silverware in hand, through the door to the kitchen. "You take in babies as well?" Dee Dee asked curiously. "Couple," the woman said, in a tone of voice Dee Dee already took to mean she was rounding down. "And how many older kids?" "I got a waiver," Mother Dell said, eyeing Dee Dee shrewdly. Waivers were the new magic of the foster care system, enabling more kids to be piled under the same roof and earning caretakers more money. Foster care was hard work, Dee Dee knew. Many families served selflessly and believed passionately in the opportunity to help a child. Somehow, though, she doubted Mother Dell fell into that category. "Don't you have another kid who lives here?" Dee Dee asked. "Mike Davis?"
"He's out."
"Doing what?"
"He's a teenage boy. Teenage boys don't like to tell you everything, just as long as he's back before curfew."
"And a girl, Anya?"
"Also out. Play rehearsal, community theater."
Dee Dee nodded, meaning Mother Dell currently had 6 kids and at least a couple of babies in her care, equaling roughly $200 a day, tax-free income 7 days a week. Where did the money go, was her next thought, because it didn't appear to be spent on the home or on dinner.
"I saw the news," Mother Dell said now.
She remained sitting in her lawn chair, her hands folded over her considerable girth. She was wearing a flowered housecoat, like the kind favored by Italian grandmothers.
Or maybe it was a moo-moo. Is it true the family's dead? Including Lola?
Yes.
The woman grimaced. Find Roxanna yet?
No.
She's smart. Always reading books, studying. She's a clever one. Good with the babies, too. Never thought of her as violent.
When was the last time you saw Roxy or Lola?
Woman shrugged. Day they left. The Casa woman came to pick them up for court. Said it was the final hearing. Reunification, something like that. If all went according to plan, they wouldn't be coming back. And they didn't.
Not even to revisit friends? Dee Dee tested.
What friends? Lola and Roxy stuck with each other. Even slept squished together on the floor of the baby's room just so they wouldn't be apart. Thick as thieves, those two.
You think Roxy would hurt Lola?
Phil spoke up. Nah. Lola, on the other hand. That girl had a wild streak. No telling what she might do. But Roxanna was all, I'm the older sister, I'm responsible. You see it in foster kids. Their parents aren't worth shit, so the kid becomes the parent.
Another massive shrug. What about Roberto and Anya? Dee Dee asked.
Roberto's dead. What about him?
We heard he committed suicide.
That's what the police told me.
Where'd he get the gun?
Choices are endless in this area. Walk to any street corner, someone will sell you something.
You don't seem that broken up about it. Phil spoke up.
It happens. Broken families, broken kids.
How long had he been with you? Dee Dee asked, frowning.
7 years.
7 years. And it happens is all you've got to say about it?
Because a foster parent and her charges are so close. You see how many kids I have here? And I'll have more the second a space opens up. This city's filled with unwanted children. I'm doing my best, but no kid wants to be in foster care. They don't walk through those doors all happy to be here. The good ones endure. The bad ones rebel. Let's just say Roberto was more bad than good.
He make trouble?
With me? No. With the other kids? I'm not as stupid as they think.
Tell us, Phil commanded.
He liked to rule the roost. When he first got here, he was middle of the pack. A year later, he was the oldest, and in his mind, that made him the boss. Younger kids, newer kids, were to do as he said.
And if they didn't?
Shrug. Maybe their blanket would go missing, or a pillow, or a toy from home. Maybe they'd find pepper in their food, toothpaste in their shoes. He could be inventive when he wanted to.
And his relationship with Anya?
You mean his girlfriend? Well, former girlfriend, given that, you know.
Dee Dee shifted from foot, the woman's callousness getting to her. You allow dating in your house?
Like at their ages, they're going to listen to anything I say. Boys and girls are kept separate under this roof, of course. But the teen fosters, they don't spend much time here anyway.
Hence Mike and Anya's absence, which Mother Dell didn't seem concerned about. Did Anya help out Roberto with his schemes?
They were together.
And their relationship with Lola and Roxanna?
Didn't like them. Lola and Roxanna came fresh from family and still had each other. In a foster's world, that can be cause for jealousy. Roberto did his best to tear them apart. I wised up to some of the games. Roberto and Anya breaking dishes, pinching babies, then pointing the finger at Roxy to take the blame. Petty stuff, really.
Dee Dee wasn't sure she agreed. You ever see the fights get physical? Roberto or Anya hit the girls? Threaten them?
No fighting. House rule. Everyone knows that.
Which would be all the more incentive to keep it quiet. Phil must have thought the same as he said, What about kids falling downstairs, running into dolls? That happen in this house?
Mother Dell shot him a glance. Roxanna fell down the stairs once, now that you mention it. But then the stairs in this place kind of match the rest of it.
Dee Dee remembered Hector's observation that Roxanna seemed to have injured ribs when he saw her at the courthouse. She wondered if that came from the alleged fall down the stairs, or if, in fact, Mother Dell was as stupid as her kids thought. You ever have to take either Lola or Roxanna for medical treatment? Dee Dee asked.
Once, but it was Lola's fault.
Dee Dee homed in. What happened?
Foolish girl drank a fifth of whiskey, like the whole bottle. I heard the babies crying, then Roxanna screaming, Mike shouting. Came upstairs to find Lola throwing up all over the damn place. Then her eyes rolled back in her head, and that was that. I bundled her off to the ER, where they pumped her stomach and lectured her on alcohol abuse.
Where'd she get a bottle of whiskey?
Phil pressed. Don't look at me. There's no booze in this house. Hell, most of these kids come from addicts. I keep even the cough syrup under lock and key.
Where were Roberto and Anya when this was going on?
Didi's turn. Standing in the doorways of their rooms, watching.
Just watching?
Mother Dell stared at her. Wouldn't you?
Lola would have been 8 years old, Phil said. A young girl. Why would she drink an entire bottle of whiskey?
I was told the mother was an alcoholic. A kid grows up seeing that. Monkey see, monkey do.
What happened afterwards? Didi asked.
That shrug again. DCF trolled around. The castle lady paid a visit. No one could find fault with anything. Girls settled back in. That was that.
No more falls down the stairs? Didi asked.
Nope.
Running into doorknobs?
Nope. Lola was acting in some community play. Oliver Twist. Roxanna worked set design. Mike, too. Roberto and Anya started joining them. Guess they got tired of fighting. Brokered a peace deal instead. Except for Mike. He quit. Can't make everyone happy.
Didi frowned, churning this around in her head. She couldn't see an 8-year-old girl suddenly chugging a fifth of whiskey in the middle of the night. It already sounded forced to her. Say, something the infamous Roberto and Anya might have pulled off, if Mike Davis's account was to be believed. Maybe Roxanna arrived too late to intervene. So Lola drank the booze. Lola ended up in the hospital. Then they decided to live happily ever after? Didi didn't buy it for a moment. Her cynical cop's mind had an entirely different spin on things. Lola went to the hospital, and then Roxanna caved. Did whatever it was Roberto wanted, just so long as they never bothered her sister again. At which point, Roberto and Anya joined her and Lola at their new hobby, the community theater, in order to keep an eye on her.
Sex? Could it be that awful? That simple? Roxanna submitted to abuse in order to keep her little sister safe?
Except why was Lola the one suddenly acting out?
God only knew what went on in a place like this.
Didi already wanted to leave, and she wasn't a helpless kid. Everything about Mother Dell, the house, smacked of hopelessness. No wonder the older kids did their best to stay away as long as possible.
You ever talked to Juanita Baez?
Phil was asking now. Girl's mom? She showed up. Different. I don't normally see the parents much. And again, not too many of my kids get reunited.
What did she want to know?
Same questions you're asking now, except she was a little more hostile on the matter. Convinced Lola was abused by some perv under my roof.
Didi watched the woman with fresh interest.
Look, Mother Dell rumbled, this house ain't no castle, and I'm no fairy godmother. But I run a clean operation. House rules strictly enforced. No drinking, no drugs, no hanky-panky. And that's that.
Where do you sleep? Didi had a thought. This number of kids, an area for babies, there can't be that many bedrooms upstairs, and they must all be taken.
Got a room downstairs.
Didi looked around.
Where? I see a family room, dining room, kitchen, that's it.
Then she got it. The front room, and its debris field of empty soda cans and chip packages.
You sleep on the sofa, don't you?
Front of the house, furthest room from the stairs. Hell, they could be tap dancing on the second floor, and you'd be none the wiser.
I'm a light sleeper, the woman growled,
but her eyes were darting back and forth now, trapped.
Truth is, you don't know what's going on in your house.
Didi pressed her advantage.
Nor do you care. You just want the money, plain and simple.
Simple? You think there's anything simple about this? I got 6 kids and 3 babies to keep clothed and fed. I don't need any lectures from some skinny blonde cop. This work is hard. These kids are hard, but I do my best. And the rules are the rules. If there was anything happening to that little girl, it wasn't on my watch.
Where, then?
School, bus, park, take your pick. Kids spend a lot of time together, you know, and not just in this house.
Didi frowned. Yes, a bunch of kids from the same home would have attended the same school, and yet...
What about this community theater?
she'd just started to say when she heard the sound of a door opening behind them. She and Phil turned. A teenage girl stood just inside the doorway. Dee Dee didn't even have to think. "Anya Seton?" she asked. The girl turned and fled. Chapter 24. After parting ways with the CASA volunteer, Mrs. Howe, I took a walk. A breeze had kicked up, the temperatures moving to the biting side of fall as the sun faded from the horizon. I hunched inside my thin windbreaker, wishing I'd thought to wear